that way instead of trying to make sure their protagonists refrain from a new exchanges of strikes. Furthermore, as far as we can say, Washington, in addition to that, provided West Jerusalem with intelligence information they needed for the strikes. This is not only a violation of international law, it destabilizes an already charged situation of the Middle East, which is already balancing on the brink of war.
China's UN ambassador also addressed the Security Council's meeting on the Israeli aggression against Iran. Fu Kang condemned the regime's attack while expressing concern over escalation of tensions caused by Israeli actions.
On October 26, Israel launched rounds of airstrikes against several sites in Iran, causing damage to facilities and casualties on the Iranian side. China condemns any violation of Iran's sovereignty and territorial integrity and opposes acts of destruction that threaten regional peace and security. At present, the Iran-Israel relations and the situation in the entire Middle East region are on the edge. We are gravely concerned about the escalation caused by Israel's action and urge Israel to effectively cease all provocative acts. At the same time, we call on all parties to exercise calm and restraint, jointly abide by the UN Charter and the principles of international law, and return to the right track of resolving disputes through political and diplomatic means.
Political commentator Kent Stone says Israel has a long history of ignoring UN resolutions and acting against the world body's charter and international law.
Well, Mr. Iravani was absolutely correct in saying that Israel's recent attack on Iran was a flagrant violation of the of international law and the UN charter. And he was also quite correct in saying that Israel acts with impunity on the world in West Asia and on the world stage because it has the backing of the United States of America, plus also NATO, the European Union, the Trudeau government of Canada. And in its attack on Iran the other night, it also had the material support of the U.S. to carry out this attack. So this impunity has been demonstrated over and over and over again for the last 75 years, from the days of the Nakba in 1947-48, when the Israelis ignored Resolution 181 to allow the Palestinian refugees to return, up to the present, when Israel went ahead and attacked United Nations peacekeeping posts in Lebanon and injured peacekeeping soldiers, and even to today, where the Israeli government apparently voted to disallow UNRWA, the United Nations Relief and Works Agency.
Israeli forces have arrested a number of protesters venting anger at Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his far-right cabinet in occupied Al-Quds. Protesters held a sit-in, chanting slogans in front of Netanyahu's residence. The regime forces forcibly removed them. Protesters had gathered to demand the Israeli cabinet end the war on the Gaza Strip and facilitate the release of some 100 captives held by the Hamas resistance movement. Early on Monday, thousands also gathered outside of the Israeli Knesset during the opening of its winter session. The reasons for the public anger against Netanyahu vary from his corruption trials to his cabinet's push for a judicial overhaul, and to the handling of the Gaza genocide. Protesters say Netanyahu is prolonging the war for his own interests. In Lebanon, the death toll keeps rising as the Israeli regime relentlessly continues pounding the country, with the focus of the attacks now being the eastern Bekaa Valley. Lebanon's health ministry reports at least 60 fatalities on Monday in several areas of Bekaa, including in the Baalbek region. The toll is expected to rise as rescue efforts are ongoing. The governor of Baalbek described the attacks as the most violent since the beginning of the Israeli aggression against Lebanon. The strikes occurred without evacuation warnings and coincided with intensified bombardment of southern Lebanon, including in the city of Tyre. Since October of last year, Israeli attacks have resulted in over 2,700 deaths and more than 12,000 injuries in Lebanon. The Hezbollah resistance movement has carried out a new round of anti-Israeli operations, targeting the regime forces and settlements with drones and rockets. In their latest operations, Hezbollah's fighters hit an Israeli Navy base near Haifa with rockets. They also struck the Ras Nakura naval site with drones. Israel's Mran air control base was hit with Hezbollah's rockets. Resistance fighters also fired rocket salvos at gathering points of the regime's soldiers, both in Lebanon and several Israeli settlements. In addition, they destroyed another Merkava tank with a guided missile, leaving its crew dead or wounded. At least half a dozen settlements were struck by Hezbollah's rockets as well. The Israeli army admitted that Hezbollah fired 115 rockets at the regime's military sites and settlements on Monday alone. I am Saleh, a correspondent, joining us from Beirut to give us the latest developments there in Lebanon. And we have Mesim Ghobsaya, who's a Palestinian scientist and author, joining us from Bethlehem. Welcome to you both. Mariam, I'll start with you. Tell us more about what should be called a massacre that has happened in the Bekaa Valley in the eastern part. What has happened there?
Well, it was definitely the bloodiest night that the Bekaa has ever witnessed since the beginning of this offensive. We're talking about more than 11 strikes in various different areas, and there were no warnings, of course, like you mentioned. There were children, of course, in many of these massacres. We have, for example, in the area of Al-Alaq, for example, there was a big number of martyrs. This included a whole family, including children, of course, and there was in the town of Ram, as well as in Britel, very high numbers of martyrs being killed in their houses. The house was completely destroyed over the heads of these families, leading to this number of casualties, and it was definitely a bloody night for the people of Baalbek and the Bekaa. And these are areas that are far away from each other, but seemingly the Israelis simultaneously we're targeting those areas at the same time. The numbers that we have so far, over 60. So we have some 63 martyrs at least, and altogether more than 170 between martyrs and injured. We're expecting also the number of martyrs to rise. Also this morning, there was at least 7 strikes on various areas in the Qlim al-Tufah area, specifically in the town of Jbeah in South Lebanon. And of course, that includes the various other strikes that continue in the border. The Israelis have been pounding the city of Khiyam since last night. We know that there were even confrontations ongoing between the resistance fighters and the Israeli occupation forces in Khiyam. And this is, of course, just part of Hezbollah's attempts to always be there to resist the Israeli forces. Hezbollah has already declared today that they have launched various attacks throughout the night, in addition to drones of attack or fleets of drones that are being launched towards further areas, or, for example, Zar'it and the Israeli forces in those areas. You also have now Hezbollah using drones, or one maybe bomb-laden drone, against a force which is perhaps even closer, so therefore increasing the number of bomb-laden drones that are being used by Hezbollah against the Israeli forces that are attempting incursions. And so yesterday we saw that there were another attempted incursion in the city of Qiyam. If you want to compare it with 2006, in 2006 they had at least 10 Merkava tanks that were completely destroyed in the plains of Qiyam, and that was considered, of course, one of the major surprises by Hezbollah against the Israelis, that they were able to destroy these tanks and not allow them to go closer into the air, their incursions, and take control of the city. Up until now, the Israelis had claimed that they entered several towns and cities, but they have not been able to take full control of those cities. Yesterday alone, Hezbollah said that they launched at least 20, at least 30 operations against Israeli forces, whether in the border, on the border, or even in further areas. This is in addition to Hezbollah's new warning towards the settlements itself. And Hezbollah has made it clear. They sent a warning to all the settlers in Kiryat Shmona and 25 other kibbutz and settlements in northern occupied Palestine to evacuate the area, since the Israeli forces in those settlements have become legitimate targets for Hezbollah's Islamic resistance.
Well, Mr. Nupsaya, we're looking at, you know, this massacre that is taking place there in the eastern Bekaa Valley. We're looking at what happened earlier on Monday in Tyre, from what we understand here, where you have 7 dead and 17 injured. And within a span of 24 hours, another massacre to happen in the Gaza Strip, where 55 Palestinians were killed, this being in the town of Beit Lahia. We know the northern part of the Gaza Strip, there's a massacre going on there. I mean, at the rate that Israel is going, that it deems anybody and anything that's against it, that it's going to be subject to death and for them to be murdered at the rate that they're going. Do you think that we're looking at, what are we looking at here in terms of what goals Israel has behind all these killings? Let's start with Lebanon first.
Well, in both Lebanon and the Gaza Strip, Israel's goals are very clear. It's a Greater Israel project that started in 1948, incrementally expanding in 1967, and they intend to expand more. They tried it in Lebanon, of course, we know the invasion of Lebanon and occupying about a third of Lebanon to the Litani River for 18 years until Israel was forced out under fire from Hezbollah and resistance forces. But that's the agenda of the Israeli Greater Israel project. That's what they intend to do. And towards that, there's no holds bar policies. Basically, it's a burned earth policy. So they are destroying everything that they think is in their way. And the Palestinian Lebanese people are, of course, in their way, so to speak. So civilians are easily targeted and so easily killed and massacred and exterminated, if we may use that term. Israel's, for example, shutting down UNRWA, United Nations Relief and Work Agency, just to the approval of the Knesset yesterday, means, of course, that millions of refugees will go without any support. This is against international law. Israel is, as you pointed out, in violation of international law, in violation of the UN Charter, should be expelled from the United Nations. Based even alone just shutting down UNRWA, that itself would be sufficient to expel Israel from the United Nations.
Thank you very much. Let me thank our correspondent, Mariam Salas, speaking to us there from Beirut. Thank you, Mariam. And Mr. Kupsaya, thank you for your contribution to our in-depth look here. With that, we come to an end for this edition of World News. Thank you so much for being with us. It's bye-bye for now.
Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website at iranradio.ir. log on to our website at iranradio.ir.
Conversation. Hello, I'm Sean Murray, and this is The Conversation, where we take an alternative look at political events and current affairs through an Irish lens. In this show, we hope to pick, probe, investigate, and uncover the stories that you want to hear. We go where mainstream won't go. This week, we look at one of Ireland's great cheerleaders of human rights, a tireless worker for her constituents, and an emphatic advocate for Palestinian self-determination. It's safe to say my next guest has been an impenetrable thorn in the side of both the Irish and European parliaments. But before we do, let's get a quick overview on this week's topic.
Since Ireland officially joined the European Economic Community on the 1st of January 1973, it has had a fractured relationship with the new and emerging economic powerhouse. On the 7th of June 2001, Ireland held a referendum on the Treaty of Nice. It was the first European referendum to be rejected by the people, defeated with 53.9% of the electorate voting no. Concerns included a loss of Ireland's neutrality, political and economic concerns due to the planned enlargement of the EU, and a reduction in Irish representation and power within the EU institutions. In response to the rejection of the treaty by the Irish electorate, the Irish government obtained a declaration that the treaty did not undermine Irish neutrality. A second referendum on the treaty was held on the 19th of October 2002. The referendum was passed with 62.89% of the electorate voting yes. On the 12th of June 2008, Ireland held a referendum on the Treaty of Lisbon. This referendum was also defeated, with 53.4% of the electorate voting no. Ireland was the only member state to hold a referendum on the treaty, and its rejection took the EU by surprise. Issues contributing to its defeat included a lack of knowledge about the treaty, the loss of a permanent EU commissioner, and concerns about a loss of national competency over issues such as neutrality and national tax rates. The Irish government then obtained a number of guarantees from EU leaders. These included a commitment that the treaty would not affect Irish law or policy on certain issues such as neutrality or tax. In addition, member states would retain a permanent EU commissioner. A successful second referendum on the treaty was held on the 2nd of October 2009, with 67.1% of the electorate voting yes. Forward to the outbreak of the Ukrainian war in 2014, and once again, Irish reservations about the direction of the EU have come to the fore. The government, along with the complicit media, have moved to shut down all debate around the circumstances of the US-NATO-led war. Any deviation from the anti-Russian narrative has seen those that call for peace labelled as Putin apologists. The fact that the war has been an economic disaster for the EU while propping up US big business is something that escapes broadsheet editorials. The attack and sabotage of the Nord Stream pipeline that fed Russian gas to the EU has seen gas prices jump four times to that of US prices. This has caused a catastrophic cost of living crisis throughout the European Union. The genocide inflicted upon the Palestinian people by Israel has also been a source of contention between EU securocrats and the overwhelming support offered by the Irish people. While the Irish government has paid lip service to the Palestinian concerns, this has not manifested with any material action. However, the Irish people have spoken. Support for the rights of a people that have been persecuted and downtrodden for over 75 years by a slow US and Israeli genocide is steadfast. There must be justice now. EU support for Israel must end.
With that, I would like to introduce my next guest. Claire Daly exploded onto the international political landscape with her election victory in 2019. A former Irish TD, her uninhibited, unorthodox style has seen her face down her enemies with great gusto and the political fluency that cuts through the fallacy of conventional political etiquettes. Loathe or love her, it's safe to say she has been a breath of fresh air amongst a pool of stagnant political careerists. Claire, welcome to the show.
Thanks very much, Sean.
So first of all, Claire, tell me, how did you get into politics and what or who influenced you?
Well, I don't know. I suppose I went to college in the 1980s, which was a period of quite intense political activity. We had a lot of cutbacks in education and health in Ireland at the time. We had the Birmingham Six. We had the struggle against apartheid. And I suppose I became politically active in student politics. And then that led later on to trade union politics, community politics, eventually being elected to a council, the Dáil, and then finally to Europe. So.
And tell me about Europe. As I've mentioned, you exploded onto the political scene in 2019 with a European election victory, representing, is it?
Dublin.
Dublin. South Dublin.
Just Dublin.
Dublin.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's four MEPs in Dublin.
Four now, yeah. There was three at the time and we got an extra one after Brexit. So your loss is our gain, or not, considering who got it, but that's another story. Dublin is the constituency.
So immediately entering European politics, what was the first thing that struck you?
It's very bizarre. I mean, I don't need to tell Irish people that Brussels and the European Union is a bubble. It's quite disconnected in the minds of people, but actually incredibly influential in their lives. But we don't realise that because the mainstream media doesn't cover what goes on. We tried actually to have the idea of a sort of a European Parliament TV, which would broadcast what's going on over there. Because what's going on over there is pretty scary. I mean, people saw the mask slip in terms of the European Union's support for the genocide in Gaza. But actually, they've been involved in all sorts of, I suppose they're totally captured by lobbyists, by the big pharma, big agri, by the military industrial complex. These are the people who are influencing policy, which is devastating the lives of people all across Europe. So, you kind of get that sense that it's a really privileged bubble, disconnected from reality, where they all reinforce their own views. It's incredibly Atlanticist, so it's totally dominated by US think tanks and US influence and, interesting. But it's a stage, and we kind of saw early on that it's a stage that is internationally recognised, and actually all of the people all across Europe think exactly the same as people in Ireland do, and indeed people outside of the European Union as well. They're sick and tired of the political establishment that is creaming it off for themselves at the expense of ordinary people and making the world an incredibly more unsafe place. So it's been amazing. That platform has given us the ear of people all over Europe and the world. I mean, I've been on every continent. On every continent, people have recognised myself and Mick Wallace and thanked us on our work, in whether it be advocating peace in Ukraine or standing up for Palestine. It's been pretty amazing.
Now, let's talk about this advocating peace for Ukraine, because, I mean, I think we're both in the club of being accused of...
Oh, you're one as well?
I'm one as well.
Yeah.
..of being a Putin apologist, just for the simple fact that you might advocate for peace. And I think the media has played a major part of that. I've seen yourself and Mick Wallace vilified, tainted, for speaking out against that. I mean, tell me about that.
It's been quite incredible. So obviously I've been an anti-war activist all of my life. So my political life is about 40 years old at this stage. And throughout that, I would have been a strong advocate, against the war in Iraq, in Afghanistan. Myself and Mick broke into the airport in Shannon to search US warplanes. We have a long history of advocating against militarism and for peace. And then we go to the European Parliament and a war breaks out in Europe. And we again argue for peace. But the media says, no, no, we couldn't possibly be arguing for peace. We must be Russian agents. Like, and it begs the question, I suppose, it's been absolutely consistent. And our views are no different than the Pope's, than Sabrina Higgins, than Jeremy Corbyn, than others. But it has been directly targeted at us in the jingoism that surrounded the war. We, of course, condemned the Russian invasion. It was illegal under international law. But all we said was it may have been unjustified, but it definitely was provoked. And that NATO had a handle in this, and that the role of the European Union should be to advocate for peace and diplomacy. And actually, the Ukrainians themselves had a peace deal on the table with Russia in April 2022. And it was the European Union, Britain and the US that told them, no, we're not going to sign off on that. You've got to keep fighting. So Ukraine is the only area in the whole world where you can't argue for peace. I mean, when we argue for what we argued for in relation to the war in Ukraine is exactly what we said in relation to Palestine. We want a ceasefire and we want a negotiated settlement. But that's not appeasing Netanyahu, but it is appeasing Putin. You couldn't make this stuff up. But the reason for it and why it was so targeted and why it was so personalised, and I'd never experienced anything like that before, was because there's always been a section in Irish society who are Europhiles. They love the European Union. They're exactly the same people who years ago would have doffed the cap to the British registered magistrate or whoever. They automatically think anything Irish is less valuable than our masters. And they've always been embarrassed that the Irish people have returned time after time Eurocritical representatives to the European Parliament. So we've had, you know, in the past, Joe Higgins, Patricia McKenna, Mary Lou MacDonald years ago, who were sort of more critical voices. And they saw the chance in the war in Ukraine to silence that. I mean, they were mortified when the Irish people rejected Nice, when we rejected Lisbon, when we had to vote again. Oh, God, they had to tell their European masters, oh, we're so sorry, they didn't understand, we'll make them vote again. It's this servile attitude, and they thought in the jingoism around the Ukraine war, this was their chance to get it. So unrelenting, targeted, defamatory lies, time and again. And you throw enough mud, a bit sticks, that's the plan. The establishment in Ireland is hell-bent on silencing a Eurocritical voice. And my God, when we see what's happening, not just in their role in prolonging the war in Ukraine and all of the hundreds of thousands of Ukrainians and Russians who've died in that slaughter, the devastation of that country, when we see the European Union now being complicit in genocide, well, I think a Eurocritical voice is absolutely necessary. But the powers that be want it out. And and the political establishment are seizing on that. It's the most basest, pathetic stuff. But it has an impact. And at the time, I can tell you it wasn't nice at the height of the war. But now, because sadly what we said has come to pass, we said if you arm Ukraine, it'll only prolong the war and obviously make a lot of people very, very rich, or a small number of people very, very rich. And also we said that sanctions will just pauperise the people of Europe and they won't harm Russia. That's happened too. The European economy is in tatters. Irish people are suffering like everyone else across Europe from a catastrophic cost of living crisis. We're paying four times the amount for American LNG now than the Americans are. They've cut off their supply with their nearest neighbour, Russia, in terms of cheaper energy. And European manufacturing is on the floor. 15 years ago, the European economy was the same size as the US one. Now it's half the size. These people are shooting themselves in both feet. And they're the ones, so they're the pro-Europeans. I don't think so. They're pro-European, well, not even pro-European business, because European manufacturing is leaving Europe. It's going to China and the US. It's absolutely ridiculous, but it shows the power of the voices that are assembled against us. Yeah, I never thought I'd see it. Like, bizarre.
Yeah.
Bizarre.
And just on that jingoism, I mean, we're well used to this in the north of Ireland here, where a former academic colleague of mine coined the phrase pleasure culture of war. There's a British pleasure culture of war, and we see that manifested everywhere. I mean, it's all around in Belfast, the street names, the hospital. But while we have been in a phase of a peace process, if you like, since 1998, that continues, this unionist and British pleasure culture of war. But I'm seeing this now with the establishment in Ireland. And we're even talking about possibly young Irish men going to fight for Europe and the future. I mean, it's absurd. What's your thoughts on that?
It's not. It's absolutely imminent, actually. And there's been no discussion in the media, because even, as you said, people like me or loathe me. I mean, what we're seeing is a silencing of dissent all across Ireland and Europe, where alternative voices are not heard. Now, there used to be a thing called an exchange of views, which would mean that you could have a different opinion. I learn from you, you learn from me, and we all come out the better of it. Now you either sing the one tune, which is a US and EU tune, or else you're some sort of a heretic. Now, as you say, and people don't realise it, we are 1 year away from the European Union becoming a defence union, and nothing can stop that. It's going to happen. We're 1 year away from the formation of a rapid deployment capacity force, which is everything in except in name a European army, because it is a standing force of land, sea and air of initially 5,000 troops, ready for combat, including into non-permissive environments, which obviously means areas where they don't want you, from a European point of view, probably to continuing exploiting Africa. I mean, they're down there already now on military missions, they say, but oh, no, no, we're there to bring values. The others are there to, in their interest, but we're there to bring values. But the Africans obviously don't think that, because it's the same as it always was with European colonialism. And you match that on the one hand. So this is happening in the next year. And at the same time, Micheál Martin in Ireland is moving to remove the triple lock. Now, this was the measure which is in place now, where Irish Defence Forces, if they go overseas, they can only go overseas with the backing of the Dáil, the backing of the government, and only with the UN mandate. And what they want to do is remove the UN mandate. They say, oh, but the Russian veto could be veto on everything. The Russians have never vetoed a peacekeeping mission. They say nothing about the US vetoing a ceasefire in Gaza, of course. That doesn't get mentioned. There's no problem with the veto. But what they're preparing for is to send Irish troops on missions which don't have a UN mandate. Now, why in God's name would any Irish men or women want to go abroad for something that doesn't have a UN mandate? That's a sort of a colonial mission on behalf of, say, German or French energy companies. And as you say, Irish men and women will be involved in that. That has never happened in our history. And that would be devastating. And that's what we're on the verge. And no discussion in the media at all. They fan these flames of, oh, to securitise, we need more on defence. And tens of billions of euros are being spent on defence. And even sort of small, well, not small things, major things like the environmental crisis, which there was a report done a week ago, which said that tens of thousands of people in Europe are going to die from acute and extreme weather. And obviously billions in business is going to be lost. So rather than coming together and dealing cooperatively with that, they're taking money out of programmes to deal with the environment and putting it into defence. You couldn't make it up. And you wouldn't read anything about this in the papers at all. At all.
So moving on to Palestine, you've been a great cheerleader for the Palestinian cause, something very close to your heart and very close to the Irish hearts, as we've seen. The Palestinians would say that the greatest support in Europe comes from the Irish people, and I'm sure there's not many would disagree with that. Since the events of October the 7th, we've witnessed a televised genocide. I mean, where is this going, Claire?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I think for all of us, this is a watershed. We use these words lightly, but it's totally true in this case. And I don't think that the similarities which are being invoked with Vietnam are exaggerated. These are seismic times where the lid is not going back on this one. Because as you say, we're watching this. It's not the first genocide. There's been horrible things carried out in humanity in the West Bank and in Gaza, but in other areas before, but never so brazenly, so openly, where a state would brag about it and have the active and in headlines complicity of the so-called civilized world who are supposed to bring values and human rights. So why are they doing that? So it's not just about clearing Gaza and imposing that settler colonial project and deep-rooting it. It's a vanguard for burning international law. It's a harbinger for a much more violent world where those norms that we've had since World War II, I mean, we know it never really applied to the big boys, the big powers. It was something that we use against our enemies. Our friends were never included in that type of thing. But now they're being bombarded absolute. And if they get away with that, then what we see is a much more violent world. This is returning to the dark days of the old powers, when the big powers used to go in and literally rape and pillage and set fire in a really might is right violent way. And this is the norms that we're establishing now. So in that sense, when we say that the struggle to defend Gaza and Palestine is the struggle for humanity and international law, that's not an exaggeration. It totally is. And I think the people, the countries, in the majority of countries in the world, the majority of the people in the world, including now critically a majority of people in Europe and in the US, and a majority, I would say, of the Jewish population as well, can see that this Zionist settler colonial project is over. I mean, it has come at an absolutely devastating price for the people of Palestine, but in the hearts and minds of people, there is no going back. So there are people now who are active on the Palestine issue, morning, noon and night, who hadn't really heard about it or engaged with it before October the 7th. I've met people who are as old as myself, women in their late 50s and that, who maybe before believed some of the propaganda when around Israel and now feel totally ashamed about that, who've given up every sort of ounce of their free time to lobby and campaign. We've academics for Palestine, medics for Palestine, the students forcing a divestment. The lid's not going back on that. If when we get a ceasefire and maybe more humanitarian aid in and all the rest of it, then the real task comes, because what happens next? The area is absolutely uninhabitable, but the world cannot tolerate a clearing of that area and the settler project being reimposed there. That cannot be allowed to happen. And I don't think it will, because international law and humanity itself will end then. So I think out of this nightmare, and it is, but the only positive is that the mask is off and people can see these colonial interests in the European Union, which they thought were values before, for what they are. And that we have a choice now. We either, you know, stand on our feet and fight this, or we die kneeling. It's literally that critical. And I think people can see it when innocent people are readily slaughtered, starved, the most barbarous atrocities carried out on them, the trauma for generations. It's horrific, but it's a sea change and watershed moment.
Well, I agree. I mean, the moral fallacy of the West has been exposed, I think, forever. That the lid's not getting put back on that. I think I'll maybe finish with something we've spoken about earlier briefly. The media. None of these things could happen without the complicity, without the cheerleading that goes on from the media. We're talking about a genocide that's been televised. I mean, both the Irish media and the British media, European-wide, we're well used to the US media. Their silence, not only their silence, but how they have shaped the narrative around Palestine is something to behold. I mean, you have been vilified, yourself, your colleague McWallace have been vilified, you've been tainted, not just about Russia, but about Palestine. How important is an alternative media?
Oh, it's absolutely critical, and I think the beginnings of it are there, because so many people have switched off the mainstream media now. There are huge problems with social media, with the algorithms and all the rest of it, but it has at least provided that alternative for people to get information in a timely and accurate way. And I think many people are sufficiently self-educated enough to know when they're reading stuff that's accurate and when they're reading stuff that isn't. So I do think there's so much springing up of alternative, you know, podcasts, websites, information in a timely way. It's critical, because, I mean, I've been in all over Europe on this issue, all over Europe, invited to speak about peace, about anti-militarism and so on. And if you take Germany, for example, like, there's no coverage at all in Germany about what's going on. There's none in the Netherlands. But yet, despite their best attempts at ruthless repression, so, you know, Yanis Varoufakis was banned from entering Germany. An event he organised with Jews for Peace was shut down on the fear of anti-Semitism, but still people continue to protest. We see the students being beaten off the streets in Amsterdam and in across the Netherlands, but it's waking people up. So the media can control it. And in Ireland, we've been absolutely pathetic. I mean, the amount of times they talk about balance, there is no balance. There are not two sides in this conflict. There is one side committing a genocide on a civilian population. That's it. end of. There is no right to self-defence. It doesn't exist in law. And allowing that to be repeated when you're taught that only exists for an external invasion. They're an occupying power. It doesn't. But still they keep, it's even in the papers today, they repeat it, they repeat it. They talk about Hamas. But do you condemn Hamas? As if that was relevant. You know, it was absolutely irrelevant when we see this genocide. So the media is instrumental. It does have an impact, but, you know, the young generation, and to be honest, Gaza has forced people, really, in a way in which maybe the war in Ukraine didn't. I think we had the beginnings of that. But, yeah, it's critical that we need these alternative mechanisms. And there's challenges thrown down to everybody in that, because while we salute the student movement in its heroism in Ireland and across Europe, and particularly the US, I mean, the trade union movement has been abysmally quiet. So the trade union movement really needs to ask questions on this. And I know that groups in Ireland, peace movement, has been in contact with them, because we have the prospect of trade union members in SIPTU and FORSA being involved in handling flights and activities on the way to the Middle East, which undoubtedly are not going on their holidays. And it's all very well slapping ourselves on the back about the dumb strike, which was actually led by the women themselves. It wasn't all plain sailing where everybody loved them and thought they were great. Everybody loves them now and thinks they're great 40 years on, when apartheid South Africa has been dismantled, but they didn't at the time. And it's the same now. There's a live genocide going on now, and the union movement has to get in on it and start refusing to handle anything on the way to Israel. Their complete backing is there in international law. They've no excuse. And if they did that, can you imagine the shot in the arm it would be for workers everywhere? It would reinvent the unions, who haven't been combative enough in defending the living standards of ordinary people. And what we have is this divide now between the haves and the have-nots, which has never been greater. We need a strong campaign and union on that. So I think Gaza encapsulates all of that, because it is humanity on trial. And in all of our lives and all of the aspects of our lives, we have to take on board what's going on and respond by organising ourselves, because politicians never change things. Ordinary people only do. It was ordinary people globally who dismantled apartheid South Africa. And it will be, and I am confident, although devastated by the circumstances, I'm very confident that the people of the world and the majority of the countries of the world will find a way. Because when you're trying to change something, the first thing to do that is understanding that the system is broken. If you don't understand that, you don't want to change it. Now so many people understand that. And we have to find a way of engaging in conversations like this and in all of the outlets that we have in organising from those conversations to build a better world.
Claire, I want to thank you once again for coming. You've been a great voice for the Irish people in the European Parliament. I want to wish you all the best of luck in the upcoming elections.
Thanks very much, Sean.
Thank you. And that does it for another week. We'd love for you to join the conversation by sharing the link to today's programme to help us grow our audience across all our social media platforms. I'd like to thank once again our special guest, Claire Daly. In the meantime, the conversation will be back next week with some more investigations and analysis. I'm Sean Murray. Bye for now.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
It guides us through life. It has taught us everything. We should learn and appreciate what it gives us.
واقعیت زندگی
and try to apply them to our daily lives.
چجوری ممکنه؟
How is it possible?
از راه قرآن.
By means of Quran.
این خوندن قرآن و تلاوت قرآن قدم اول است برادران من این قدم آخر نیست.
Reading and recitation of the Quran is the first step, brothers, not the last one.
هو الذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين.
It is he who has sent his apostle with the guidance and the religion of truth, that he may make it prevail over all religions, though the polytheists should be averse.
والذي أرسل رسوله بالهدى ودين الحق ليظهره على الدين كله ولو كره المشركون.
تلاوت قرآن با صوت خوش، با آداب که شیوه خاصی دارد، موسیقی خاصی دارد، روش خاصی دارد، اینها چیزایی لازم نیست.
Recitation of the Quran in nice tones should be performed according to particular methods and tones.
اما این کافی نیست.
But it's not enough.
مشکل بزرگ مسلمانان دنیا دوری از قرآن. دوری از قرآن. از قرآن.
Muslims major problem is losing touch with the Quran. Quran. Quran.
کتاب الله.
Ask the followers of the remembrance if ye know not.
You are listening to the program The Key on Iran Radio with Sheikh Shiraz, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program, The Key, here at IRIB, English Radio. Today on The Key, we are going to be examining an interesting question. That question is often posed by people. The question is this: what is it that causes bounties to remain? As you know, all of us have been given bounties by Allah. But sometimes those bounties are taken away from us. And, you know, they are unable to subsist. And the question people ask is, you know, why is it that sometimes God gives us a bounty and is taken away from us? And also, what can we do so that that bounty is not taken away from us and it remains with us? In order to answer this question, we can take inspiration from the Holy Quran, as well as the beautiful hadiths which have been narrated from the infallible Imam, alayhi wasalam. In one beautiful hadith, it's been narrated that the Holy Prophet said this. In one verse of the Holy Quran, we read the following: if the people of the towns had been faithful and God-wary, we would have opened to them bounties from the heaven and the earth, but they denied. So we seized them because of what they used to earn. So God-wariness, meaning piety, taqwa, as well as iman and faith, are things that allow bounties to increase and also allows them to subsist and persist. In another verse of the Holy Quran, we read this: that is because Allah never changes a blessing that He has bestowed on a people unless they change what is in their own souls. And Allah is all-hearing, all-knowing. So if we preserve our good characteristics, such as faith and the other, you know, qualities which are associated with it, then the blessings that God has bestowed upon us will subsist and remain. In a beautiful hadith, it's been narrated that the Holy Prophet said, Allah has servants whom He has chosen for bounties. He establishes these in them as long as they distribute them to people. But if they withhold them, the bounties, meaning if they withhold the bounties, He transfers them to other people. So being stingy, not sharing the bounties you have been given, these are things that can lead to those bounties being withheld and taken away from you. Imam Ali alayhi salam said, He upon whom the bounties of Allah are plenty, people's need from Him increase accordingly. So if he uses them for Allah in the way he must do, he causes them to continue and remain. But if he does not use them in the way that he must, he will make them cease and perish. So one of the causes of bounties being taken away is that a person does not use them as they should be used. But if he uses them in a proper way, then those bounties will subsist and persist. Finally, Imam As-Sadiq alayhi salam said the following: bounties will not remain unless after having three things, knowledge of the status of Allah and the blessings being from Him, meaning so we should recognize that they are from Allah, fulfillment of thanks for them, meaning we should be thankful for them, and striving with them, meaning we should use them and make an effort to use them in good deeds and for good purposes. These are the things that can cause these bounties to remain. Thank you for joining us here on The Key. We were looking at what causes bounties to remain in the light of the Quran and the Hadith. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
You just listened to the program The Key on Iran Radio with Sheikh Shiraz, a graduate of Islamic Seminary of Qom.
You can also send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Lebanon says Hezbollah names Sheikh Naim Wassam as the resistance movement's new head, replacing Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, who was assassinated in September by the Israeli regime. Iran and several countries condemned the Israeli aggression against the Islamic Republic during a UN Security Council meeting, calling the attack blatant breach of international law. And Israeli forces carry out another massacre in the northern Gaza Strip, raising the genocide and death toll to over 43,000. Well, welcome to our studios in the capital, Tehran. This is News. Thanks for joining us. Lebanon's Hezbollah resistance movement has named Sheikh Naim Wassam as its new leader. In a statement, Hezbollah said that Qassam will replace Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah, who was assassinated by the Israeli regime in an Israeli airstrike in late September. The statement says that Qassam has been elected due to his, quote, adherence to the principles and to the goals of Hezbollah. Sheikh Qassam previously served as the Deputy Secretary General under Nasrallah. Sheikh Qassam was born in southern Lebanon, and his political activism began with the Amal movement in 1979. He joined Hezbollah after the formation in early 80s. As a prominent spokesman, Sheikh Qassam has engaged extensively with foreign media and has coordinated Hezbollah's parliamentary election campaigns for decades. Our Beirut correspondent Mariam Saller earlier joined us to provide more details on the election of Sheikh Naim Qassam as Hezbollah's new chief. Let's take a listen.
This is, of course, a very significant step that Hezbollah has taken, especially in light of the war. Many had thought that perhaps Hezbollah would wait until things perhaps die down, or maybe there is some sort of an end to this war until they actually go for electing the president. Many had also considered and bargained on the fact that they were able to, the Israelis have assassinated many of the members of the High Administrative Council of Hezbollah, and so therefore Hezbollah would not be able to have all its members to be able to elect a secretary general. And if we want to also talk about this, how it could be perhaps a step that was a bit difficult, because Hezbollah had been electing Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah for the last 30 years. So it became more of a routine election because all the members had agreed that it was Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah who was to be secretary general. Now, with the fact that you had perhaps a new names, or it wasn't clear if there were other candidates as well. Perhaps the members of the council all together were candidates and there was a unanimous election. I do not have a clear information on how this election took place and how the agreement was among all the members.
Same with Lebanon, where the death toll keeps rising as the Israeli regime continues pounding the country.